The headlines say overdose deaths are way down. Is this a cause to celebrate? I'm Dr. Brent Schollinger, along with my colleague, Dr. Abby Strauss. And joining us to dig down deep into this issue is Kellen Russoniello. Kellen is Director of Public Health and a senior staff attorney at the New York City-based nonprofit Drug Policy Alliance. That organization aims to reduce the harm of both drug use and prohibition through health-centered drug policies. Kellen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
The headlines are blasting overdose deaths way down. There's a concern that a lot of people read that and they think, gee, we've solved the opioid epidemic. We've solved drug addiction. It's under control. Your take on that?
Well, certainly any decrease in the number of overdose deaths that we are seeing is a good thing. But what's important to point out here is over 80,000 people continue to lose their lives every year in this country due to a drug overdose. That's far too many. We need to continue to fund and invest in the services that are leading to the decrease and make sure that we are continuing down that path rather than backtracking.
If we look at that data, did this apply to all 50 states in the U.S.? And what type of percentage decrease in overdose deaths are we looking at?
In the United States, it's been a pretty monumental decrease in overdose deaths, somewhere around 30% decrease in overdose deaths from previous years. This is down from the pinnacle that we've seen during the COVID-19 pandemic era, and that's really when fentanyl spread across the drug supply across the United States. In those years, we were seeing over 100,000 deaths from overdose across the country. We are now around the 80,000 range, which again, is far too many people dying every year from overdose, but certainly a much welcome decrease. We are correct to ask about whether this is something that's being experienced the same across the country. In most parts of the country, we are seeing a decrease, but there are still states where there have been increases, including Washington, California, and also states like Nevada. This is also sort of belies what's going on at the even more local granular level. There are still hot pockets, you know, in each state where overdose deaths continue elevated numbers compared to other parts of the state or the country. And it's also important to note that there are racial disparities baked into this as well. We are seeing more of a decrease in overdose deaths among white populations. We are seeing total numbers come down, but we are seeing still increasing rates in Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. Overdose deaths in those communities continue to rise, even though the overall death rate is dropping. So we still need to pay much attention to this issue, both at the local level and to make sure that communities of color are still receiving resources and we're not declaring victory yet.
Many people have associated the onset of the fentanyl crisis with COVID. Was it just coincidental, or is there a sense that the COVID actually triggered it? Because we don't have COVID anymore. You would think, therefore, if that was a trigger. But the words are so commonly used in the same, I'll say, paragraph, not necessarily sentence. Did COVID somehow? Where's it coming from?
Fentanyl actually entered the drug supply in a major way pre-COVID. Going back about to 2015 is when we really started to see fentanyl enter the drug supply, particularly on the East Coast of the country. And that's where we saw the overdose deaths really start to increase first. And over the span of the next 5 or so years, fentanyl entered the drug supply moving westward. Really in about 2019, 2020, that's when we saw the COVID-19 pandemic, but that's also when we saw fentanyl hit the West Coast drug supply in a major way. We were experiencing a perfect storm, at least on the West Coast part of the country during those years where fentanyl was entering the drug supply. People who were using drugs had to adapt to that. And we also had COVID-19 impacting your access to harm reduction programs, drug treatment programs, and even just connection with each other. We really had this circumstance where people were using from a drug supply that they were not used to using from and potentially using in ways that they were not used to doing, including in more social isolation, which we know increases your risk of overdose.
Give us a synopsis. Why it's so dangerous? Why is it different than heroin or something else? Again, a brief synopsis.
Fentanyl is a very highly potent synthetic opioid. Essentially very easy to overdose compared to heroin because it takes much less of the drug to overdose. For somebody who was used to using a certain supply and then fentanyl enters that supply, perhaps without them even knowing, it's much more likely that they would overdose in response to taking that drug. For the past about 10 years, what we've seen is about 70% or more drug overdose deaths involve synthetic opioids, primarily fentanyl.
Certainly, fentanyl, we can say, played a big factor in the rise of overdose deaths. What do you think are the major reasons for this change, this 30% or so decrease in the deaths?
I think it's pretty complicated. We don't know exactly what's driving this major decrease. We do know that part of it must be our investing in harm reduction and overdose prevention services, including the distribution of naloxone, which is opioid antagonist drug, which reverses a overdose. We know that getting that into the hands of people who use drugs, community organizations that work with people who use drugs, had an impact in reversing overdoses and saving lives. We also know expanding access to things like methadone and buprenorphine, which are medications for the treatment of opioid use disorder, can cut their overdose risk by half. As we expand, the opportunity for people to have those medications with overdose is becoming less likely. There's also just things we haven't had so much control over, like changes in the drug supply. And these are things that we need to continue to watch. More sedatives in the drug supply, including xylazine and metatomidine, which don't carry the same overdose risk as opioids, but might come with other health risks that we need to be careful of, including skin infections.
Certain politicians, they like to claim that these numbers are down because of their ramped up war on drugs, closing the borders, et cetera, et cetera. How do you respond to that?
We just don't have the evidence for that. It doesn't line up with the spending or the seizure numbers that we've seen that the overdose deaths would drop in correlation with those. We also have over 50 years of evidence showing that the war on drugs doesn't decrease overdose deaths or really improve any of the public health outcomes that are associated with drug use. And what we do have is something that researchers call the iron law of prohibition, which is essentially the more that you try to crack down and enforce on a drug, the more potent and easier to conceal it will become. And you can actually chart out the rise in overdose deaths going back to crackdowns on pharmaceutical companies who were marketing opioids. We don't have the evidence for that. It doesn't seem like that would be supported by what we're actually seeing.
If we just focus on fentanyl per se, a number of states, including Florida, have ramped up penalties for sale or possession of fentanyl. Is this going to have much of any impact?
It might have an impact, but it might not be a positive impact. As we crack down on these substances, we start to see other substances enter the market. And perhaps that's part of the reason why we're seeing these other new drugs enter the market. What we do know is when you do criminalize drug use, it sends people back into the shadows, which makes it much harder to engage them in life-saving services like getting them into methadone or buprenorphine treatment. We also know that criminal legal system comes with racial disparities. So by and large, the people who are going to be arrested and incarcerated for fentanyl-related offenses are going to be people of color. And then, of course, arrest and incarceration comes with its own host of public health impacts. We know from over 50 years of enforcing the war on drugs that criminal penalties haven't had the public health benefits that we've been promised. So we should be moving more in a direction of treating this as a public health issue and investing in those services like naloxone and treatment rather than continuing to invest in failed enforcement.
Has experience given us a better mechanism of treating this than others? Is medication-assisted treatment the answer? Suboxone the answer? Contingency management the answer? Or is it old-fashioned Narcotics Anonymous or combination? Because people want to know where this is coming from, because we never seem to be able to get rid of the scourge of substance abuse. I'll put it this way. We've had periods of lesser or greater frequency, but nothing significant. So what seems to work? And I'm going to extend this. And I'm glad you're discussing this because it's so very important, having people with Narcan and not as many deaths. This is good for statistics. It's not taking away the problem. Your thoughts about that? Because I think ultimately that's where we have to go.
I would start off with the premise that the idea of a drug-free society is essentially not an idea based in reality. We should be focused on policies that accept that reality and are going to help people move towards making healthy decisions for themselves. So that includes things like harm reduction and overdose prevention that keep people alive until the point when and if they're ready to access treatment and recovery services. But in response to your point about what do we need in terms of like what type of treatment, the answer is all of the above. We know that medications for opioid use disorder like methadone and buprenorphine are the gold standard for people who have opioid use disorder. And so we definitely need more providers who are prescribing those medications. But we also do need more contingency management, which is the most effective behavioral intervention that we have for stimulant use disorders. We don't have medication currently for stimulant use disorders that's been approved by the FDA. So we definitely need more access to those types of behavioral interventions. For many people, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think that that should be confused for treatment. It's separate to social support network, but that's a necessary component for a lot of folks. Treatment needs to be able to respond to the needs of the individual rather than the individual have to fit into a mold.
Talk about these various options for treatment for supportive care. A lot of that needs to be funded. And we have a mindset on some of the high political levels lately. Cut funding for SAMHSA, cut Medicaid funding. Where's this going to leave us?
The investment in the health services are what we believe has been a big part in the decrease in the overdose deaths that we've seen. And we're worried that cuts to funding is going to reverse that progress. Already over $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid. Medicaid is the largest payer of substance use disorder treatment in this country. So that's likely going to have some very negative impacts on access to care, including access to things like methadone and buprenorphine. We're also seeing proposed cuts to SAMHSA and the CDC, ranging from complete disassemblement of those agencies and reassemblement into the Administration for a Healthy America, but also just proposed funding cuts for things like tracking overdose deaths or funds for getting naloxone into the hands of people who need it. So we're really concerned that these and other federal cuts are going to have an impact and really start reverse the progress that we've seen.
What about the notion of just more ready availability of Narcan? I know that there have been discussions about actually putting it in vending machines. It would seem like you can go out and use the fentanyl because right across the street is a vending machine that you don't have to worry about overdosing and dying. There's a certain counterintuitiveness at one level, but an absolute cleverness in terms of contingency management on the other level. It still doesn't speak to the basic reason as to why the person's taking the fentanyl, but it's a completely different, Brent used the word mindset. Where do we go with this? How do we help? What do we do?
Making sure that naloxone is in the hands of people who use drugs and their close ones is very important for reversing overdose death numbers. And the most impactful ways to do that, the research has shown, is by directly giving it to people who use drugs and their family members and distribution through syringe service programs. We are seeing more jurisdictions start to implement models like the vending machines, and we will see what sort of impacts those have. Hopefully it will help to increase the access to people who use drugs. There has been no indication in the research that having naloxone available on hand increases somebody's risk. This is more about if somebody's going to use, they have a life-saving tool so that they don't die. If a person survives and if they're connected to services like harm reduction, it's much more likely that they will actually access treatment down the road. It's very hard to access treatment if you're dead. We need more of these life-saving interventions. And honestly, most people, using naloxone is not a very pleasant experience unless it's being titrated by like an expert, because it sends you into withdrawal. It's not a pleasant experience, but it is a life-saving tool that's necessary to have in the hands of people who use drugs so that they can live one more day and make sure they're being connected to those services that are going to help them.
So we accept this CDC data that the overdose deaths are down substantially from mid-2023 to mid-2024. So we have that data on overdose deaths. Do we have any data on non-fatal overdoses? Are those down?
I don't have hard data on that, but it is something we still need to continue to monitor, particularly as we have these other drugs entering the drug supply, and we don't have drugs like naloxone that can reverse the overdoses from drugs like stimulants, cocaine, methamphetamine, or benzodiazepines, which might be part of the drug supply. So we do need to continue to invest in tracking that data, but that's another thing that's being threatened by the cuts to CDC and other agencies.
It brings up an excellent point, because are we in effect saying, use the fentanyl, don't worry about it, naloxone's across the street?
People are going to use anyway, whether or not they have naloxone on. Is the person going to use and not have it on hand and potentially die? What we really should be doing is when an overdose intervention occurs, that is a opportunity to try and engage that person in services. So we should be following up with that person, seeing what resources that they need. Are they interested in accessing treatment or having discussions about their drug use? This is about saving lives. This is about making sure the person is still alive. Person in the throes of a opioid use disorder, they're going to continue to use whether or not naloxone's on hand. This is about making sure that they're alive to access services in a future date.
And to that point, I'll say we do have a number of progressive programs here in Palm Beach County dealing with exactly that issue at the time of the overdose to offer options in a non-judgmental, non-pressured way. Overdose deaths clearly are down, but isn't true that as we have fewer deaths, we have more people suffering from substance use disorder who are in the survivor category, survivors who need help. You can say, oh, he's not dead, but is he necessarily okay?
And that's why another thing that we're concerned about is these cuts to all the services that people need. We need to make sure that we're investing in services so that when somebody is ready to access treatment or other services, they're available. Because right now, what we see across the country, even without many of these proposed cuts going into effect, is that people can't get access to services. There's long waiting lines to get into treatment programs. If it's not available immediately, a person who uses drugs is not going to wait 3 weeks. You know, they might not even be around in 3 weeks. This is something that has been a chronic issue in this country for a long time. It's just a ability to access treatment. And even when they do access treatment, whether that's a treatment that's going to meet their needs, and it's going to be threatened even more as these proposed funding cuts potentially become reality.
If the cuts cause overdose deaths to actually spike again, there's a good chance the administration will just take steps to stop counting overdose deaths. That's a whole nother issue. However, something that's concerned me for a long time is this obsession with just focusing on overdose deaths. That's seems to me is just one aspect, just one parameter of the whole substance use disorder arena. Your thoughts?
Correct. Obviously, it's a very serious impact of drug use. Like you mentioned, there's whole other aspects that non-fatal overdose, skin tissue infections, the whole issue of incarceration that's associated with drug use disrupts their whole life. And when it costs money to incarcerate that person, and in fact, when they come out, their risk of overdose is even higher due to decreased tolerance while they've been incarcerated. It's a broad issue, and overdose is certainly a big part of it, but it's not the whole story.
You've mentioned skin issue infections. That's from injections?
That can be from injections, but it's also something that we're starting to see more of in relation to drugs like xylazine in the drug supply, which appear to cause more skin issues.
So dermatology may end up playing a bigger role in this than it did historically.
That's right.
Overdose deaths are down, but should we really get that excited about it? And I think there's a great deal of complacency in not just the medical community, but in the public in general. Oh, great, the deaths are down. Yeah, we're doing great. What can we do? Because clearly from what you're saying, what can we do to counterbalance this false sense of complacency?
And I would agree. I think we are in a sense of sort of cautious optimism. We would like to see this progress continue, though we are worried about the trajectory of where this administration wants to go in terms of its funding cuts. Over 80,000 deaths a year, it's a public health issue. It's very sad and unfortunate that we've come to the state where many people say, oh yeah, it's good news. But I've been hearing about overdose deaths for the past 10 years now, kind of become numb to it. That's a very sad state to be in. You know, we've lost over 1 million people since the turn of the century to overdose deaths. And this is a completely preventable cause of death if we have the right tools in place at the right time. Most people in this country know somebody or have been directly impacted by the overdose crisis. Everybody has a stake in this. Really, we should be able to activate everybody, continue to invest in the responses that are working on this problem, and stop wasting our time on things that aren't working.
Give us again, what is your organization all about? What do you do? Help put a little perspective in why you are in a position to talk as eloquently and with the insight and with the experience that you are addressing this. Who is your organization?
So we are the Drug Policy Alliance. We are a nonprofit that is dedicated to investing in public health solutions to drugs. So that includes investing in solutions that are public health based and not based through the criminal legal system, and essentially making sure that we address the harms of both drug prohibition and drug use itself, and making sure that people who use drugs are recognized members of our communities and have access to the health services that they need to survive and thrive.
Good.
A specific message for our physician audience, what would that be?
Physicians have a huge role to play in this. Certainly, we need more physicians on the front lines who are doing methadone and buprenorphine prescription for people who have opioid use disorder. We also just generally need more education in the medical realm around substance use disorders. Many of your patients are going to be people who use drugs, and whether they do that with a problematic substance use disorder or they do it, you know, recreationally without any sort of substance use disorder attached to it, those are your patients, and you need to treat them as human beings and also be able to connect them or provide the services that they need in order to address their drug use in the way that they, you know, want to and is appropriate for them. Physicians know about substance use disorder and know how to help their patients.
Talking about funding sources for this, there's something like $50 billion in opioid settlement money out there over the next 20 years or so. Are you optimistic that this is going to be allocated in a good direction?
This is a very hot topic right now, especially with the federal funding cuts across the board. So as a result, litigation brought against opioid manufacturers and distributors and others for the heavy marketing of prescription opioids, primarily back in the early 2000s, those companies entered into settlements to pay counties and states for their role in increasing opioid use disorders. So many counties and states and cities have these funds supposed to be going towards quote-unquote opioid abatement. So essentially activities like substance use disorder, syringe service programs, naloxone distribution, prevention, recovery services, those types of things. But once the money is in the hands of cities, counties, and states, essentially up to them how that money is spent. So we do have good examples of that money going towards the types of programs that it is supposed to fund. But then we also have examples of abuse. There's a really great website called opioidsettlementtracker.com that tracks all these, you know, to the best of the ability that the public data is available about where money is going. We've seen some not great examples of money going towards things like paying for law enforcement gymnasiums and those types of things. A lot of this boils down to how engaged activists are at the city, at the county, and the state levels to make sure that those funds are going towards the things that they are supposed to be. That is an opportunity to make sure that those funds are going towards the right things, but it is also under threat because it is a new sort of pot of money, and also because federal funding cuts are going to be impacting budgets at the city, county, and state level. Those levels of government might be interested in using that source of funding to sort of other services that are being cut. It's going to really come down to folks on the local level standing up and making sure that the government is putting that money where it's supposed to go.
From what you've been able to observe and experience as you develop these programs and deal with all the alliance issues to bring better treatment to the communities, are you finding that communities generally are pleased with that, they're comfortable with it, or is there a sense of skepticism that this is money that's not being well spent?
There are aspects of this that there's almost universal agreement that it's money well spent, and that would include things like naloxone distribution, fentanyl test strips, those types of interventions to make sure people are staying safe and alive. Other interventions that have come under recent attack, and those attacks have actually been echoed by the presidential administration, things like syringe service programs, which we know from over 40 years of evidence, are effective public health interventions that help to reduce the risk of HIV and hepatitis, and also connect people to services, including substance use disorder treatment. Those things have been coming under public scrutiny in places where they have long existed, including in cities like San Francisco and Philadelphia. And the rhetoric is being echoed all the way up through the presidential administration. This is rhetoric that is essentially being used to justify going back to the tough on crime, war on drugs mentality that we had in the 1980s and 1990s, which we know didn't work. We need to continue to get past that rhetoric and to invest in the services. We know syringe service programs work. We know naloxone distribution works. We know safer smoking kits works, which is an important thing to continue to invest in, because in routes of administration is another thing that has been changing recently. More people are moving from injecting to smoking, which is actually can help reduce the risk of overdose in itself. That's an interesting wrinkle to this as well, is whether that's played a role in reducing overdose deaths. We can't get stuck in sort of the political battle over language. We need to continue to invest in things that we know work, and we have decades of evidence showing that they work.
One of the things that has always struck me impressively is that when the government began to be very aggressive and very serious in countering cigarette use, It took time. But look what happened. Look at the benefits that our society has gained from dealing with nicotine addiction. It's been dramatic. The medical issues alone still exist. People still get lung cancer, to be sure. But it's not as prevalent, and there's not this almost pointing a finger at somebody because you smoked, you got cancer. We helped them. It worked. It worked. I would love to see the equivalent, and it's going to take time. We may need some different tools, of course, but it worked. Look, we succeeded.
I think that's a great example of what potentially a public health regulatory approach to other drugs might look like. We saw huge decreases in the number of people who smoked, but we didn't throw people who smoked in jail. I think there's a lot of examples from how we responded to smoking that could be applied. You take a lot more of the control back through a regulatory system than letting the street essentially decide what's in the drugs.
You referenced before that drug-free America is really something unobtainable. It's just the way humans are hardwired. Addiction is part of the personality of a certain segment of the population. With that in mind, what would you say are your goals of drug policy?
We want to treat drug use as a public health issue, so we know that people will use. We know that most people who do use don't develop a substance use disorder, and so our policy should not be made around the people who have the worst of the worst problems. It should also take into account that people use drugs for a variety of reasons, and most of the people who do don't have problems with them. We also need to make sure that if people do develop problems, that we have resources there to respond. That includes harm reduction, that includes overdose prevention, it includes substance use disorder treatment, but it also includes things like making sure people have housing, people have food to eat, they have clothes to wear, and that we're not just responding to all our social problems with arrest and incarceration. Ultimately, we need to start considering things like safer supply and regulatory models. A lot of the problems, particularly overdose deaths that we're seeing, is because we don't have a regulated drug supply in this country and people don't know what they're getting. We are looking, you know, at models that are being experimented with in countries around safer supply, but that is something that we need to have a conversation about here is addressing overdose deaths and our toxic drug supply. Then we need to consider making a safer supply.
Kellen Russoniello is Director of Public Health and Senior Staff Attorney at the Drug Policy Alliance. Kellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.